We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, and we're also pleased to have here in the studio with us this morning, Stig Fredriksen. The event you just heard is happening on the campus this afternoon. He'll be giving a talk. This is part of the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4. And the topic is his experiences reporting on the Kremlin and the KGB back in the 1970s from our correspondent in Moscow. That's the title of the talk. It's free and open to anybody who would like to attend. So if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, feel free to stop by. Today, our guest, Stig Fredriksen, is one of the leading journalists of Scandinavia and has reported on stories all over the world, including, just to name one example, the inauguration in January of 2009 of Barack Obama. He covered that for Swedish television. Back in the early 1970s, he was a young reporter working in Moscow, representing the several news agencies of Scandinavia in Sweden, Finland, Denmark, and Norway. He's a fluent Russian speaker. Came to know a lot of people in Moscow, and one of the people he came to know through the course of his work, the writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And we'll talk about how it is that, in fact, our guest became something of a conduit for information that Mr. Solzhenitsyn wanted to get out of Russia and to the West, including the text of his acceptance of the Nobel Prize for Literature that he was awarded. Questions as we talk here, our questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We also would be happy to accept questions, comments by email, and that address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for having me.
I understand that just as a way of beginning to talk a little bit about your background, that you got your training in Russian in the Swedish military?
Yes. Right? There was and there is still a Swedish army language school. And that's where I learned Russian. This was during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And the Swedish Army prepared for the eventuality.
Yeah, perfectly understandable that they would think it important to have Russian speakers there.
Yes.
And all through Scandinavia, since you were right in the neighborhood there of the Soviet Union.
That's right. I suppose also that was part of the reason why I then became a correspondent in Moscow, that I knew Russian. I was only 26 when I was asked to go to Moscow to be a correspondent.
Had you thought before that about being a reporter?
Yes. Yes, actually, my first visit to the Soviet Union after I had finished the Army language school was a trip together with a friend. We took his car and we camped around the Soviet Union as two students. And we traveled in this little Volkswagen through Moscow down to the Black Sea, to Yalta, to the Crimean Peninsula. And then we went back through Ukraine to Czechoslovakia. And we spent a week in Czechoslovakia in August 1968 and saw the height of the Prague Spring, the freedom movement in Czechoslovakia. And then we took the car and went up through Poland. And when we passed the border between Czechoslovakia and Poland, we met the invasion, the Warsaw Pact invasion of Czechoslovakia in August 68. And then I decided I had to be a reporter because I had seen something and I wanted to tell people about this. And I got interested in reporting on international
When
news.
You were on this trip with your buddy, you know, traveling around in places in Russia and so forth, did that attract any local attention? Did people see you and think, who were these guys and what were they up to?
Yeah, but, I mean, they were very friendly meetings, I remember, because, I mean, it must have been very unusual to have two Westerners at campsites in Leningrad, in Moscow, in Yalta, in Kharkov. And we met other tourists from the rest of the Soviet Union who were also camping and seeing their country. So for us, it was very, very interesting. And,
So what when you first arrived in Moscow then as a reporter in the early 70s, what was the atmosphere of Moscow like at the time?
We saw it, we experienced this as very hostile. We saw Moscow as a city, a very uniformed, militarized city in high alert. And although we came from Sweden, which was then formally a neutral country, we were still part of the capitalist camp. And the Western correspondents were looked upon in a hostile fashion by the KGB, by the authorities. And our movements were very restricted. The traveling was very restricted. The reporting was restricted. We lived in an apartment in a foreigner's compound, a foreigner's ghetto, which was blocked off from the rest of the Russians. And we had to assume that our apartment was bugged and that my telephone, of course, was bugged, and no Soviet citizens could visit us in our apartment.
Mm. You know, the challenge for a reporter, obviously, in covering any government is that the government has one view of things they want to get out, and the reporter obviously has different sorts of ideas. And if you're operating in a situation like this, I'm sure it's particularly difficult. How did you go about trying to meet people, to talk with people, particularly people who might have had views that the government was trying to suppress?
Well, I have often thought that maybe we Western correspondents at that time, we exaggerated the dissident story, but the dissident story was our only way of working as a normal reporter, to work freely. But, of course, we had to see them on their conditions. We had to see them in their apartment, in their kitchen, if they dared to invite us, or we had to see them in the open air, on the street. Even my wife and I would have to take a walk in a park sometimes if we wanted to discuss something that was sensitive.
Because you knew that there were listening devices in the place where you were living.
Yes, in the apartment. Yeah. Yes.
How did you first come to meet Alexander Solzhenitsyn?
Well, you know, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1970, and he didn't go to Stockholm to receive it. He was afraid that he would not be let back again to Moscow. And by the time I got to Moscow, he had still not received his Nobel Prize, and the Swedish Academy had planned to come to Moscow to give him the prize in Moscow. And the Swedish Academy turned to my boss in Stockholm, the foreign editor of the news agency, who happened to be Solzhenitsyn's translator from Russian to Swedish. He had translated his Nobel Prize books. And the Swedish Academy turned to him, and my editor asked me if I could contact Solzhenitsyn. I got the address of his wife's apartment in Moscow just to ask if they needed anything for this ceremony. And then it never came about because the secretary of the Swedish Academy was refused a visa to come to Moscow. The ceremony had to be canceled. Mm-hmm. But I had this contact then, and at that first meeting, just to talk about the ceremony, we had also agreed to meet a week later or so outside the apartment near one of the railway stations in Moscow. And that's where we had our first secret meeting.
Yeah. This must have been extraordinarily difficult because over the next couple of years, you had a number of meetings with him and you had to take elaborate precautions to try to keep those meetings secret. I am sure that the Soviet government would have been very interested in what was happening and what Mr. Solzhenitsyn did and any involvement that you would have. How did you manage to meet with him as many times as you did and have that be undetected?
I still don't have a good answer to that. It's true what you say. I always thought that if there was one single person in the whole of the Soviet Union that the KGB should have constant watch on,
it would be him.
Yeah. And I also thought that they had all the resources in the world to follow him. But I know that because he was living just outside Moscow at the dacha, the summer house of the famous cellist Rostropovich. He was not even allowed to spend the night in his wife's apartment in central Moscow as part of the persecution against him. But when he was supposed to meet me at the Belarusian railway station at 8 o'clock in the evening, he would take the commuter train from outside Moscow into Moscow, hop off, take another commuter train, travel for several hours, switch from train to the metro, travel on the metro for many, many hours, and switch trains, until he thought that he had just thrown away all his shadows and all his followers. And I used to leave the foreigner's compound a few hours before, park maybe somewhere, park my car, walk several hours before I was approaching the site. And somehow they didn't catch. They didn't catch on. Hmm. Much later I asked him, after the fall of the Soviet Union, why the KGB failed to detect our secret meetings. And he said, you know, Stieg, even in the most accomplished organization, there are incompetent people. Plus, we were so smart, he said. And he had a very satisfied look on his face.
Our guest in this hour of focus, Stieg Fredriksson. He's a Swedish journalist and one of now Scandinavia's leading journalists. In the early 70s, he was a young reporter, just in his 20s, and he was working in Moscow, representing several Scandinavian news agencies. And in the course of that work, he came to meet and know Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He will be talking about some of that relationship and some of that experience in a talk on the campus of the university this afternoon. This is an event in the Millercom series from our correspondent in Moscow, reporting on Solzhenitsyn, the Kremlin, and the KGB. That's this afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory. And anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome and should stop by. Also, questions here on the show, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, as you explained, Mr. Solzhenitsyn was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. This was 1970. He did not go to attend the ceremony to accept the prize because he was afraid that then the Soviet authorities wouldn't let him come home again. Then the idea was, well, the people from the Swedish Academy wanted to come to Moscow and give him the prize. And the Russian government, Soviet government, wouldn't give him a visa to come in. So there was this impasse. He composed an acceptance speech, and there's an amazing story here about how it is that you were involved in smuggling the text of the speech out of Russia and back to Sweden. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, that happened during that first secret meeting. There was a late evening in April. In a dark courtyard, and both our wives were accompanying us. Suddenly he asked me if I could help him take the Nobel lecture out to Sweden, and I said yes. And of course, I have been thinking a lot over the years since then why I said yes, but he was not a man that was easy to say no to. Mm-hmm. And I also felt that it was a big, big adventure to be part of all this. I mean, it was very exciting that he asked me. Solzhenitsyn was at that time the biggest name among the dissidents. He was so harassed and persecuted and isolated, also by his own choice. And none of the other correspondents saw him or had any contact with him. And I got this chance. Plus, I felt that it was so unfair that he was so isolated. He was waging a one-man war against the whole Soviet system, against Soviet communism. And I came from a country where we take all these freedoms for granted, that you can, for example, send a letter without it being intercepted by the censorship. So I felt it was unfair. Anyway, I said yes to him, and he gave me not the text of the lecture, but he had filmed the lecture. He gave me 9 black and white negatives he had taken with his camera. And when I got back to the apartment, I cut these negatives and put them in plastic, and I took a tin tube with headache tablets and emptied it, and I put the film in that tin tube, and I took a transistor radio I had, and I unscrewed the back and took out the batteries, and this tin tube with the film fitted right into where the batteries were, and I screwed the transistor together and put the radio in my suitcase and took the train to Helsinki. Because it was planned already before that I was going to Helsinki for a meeting with my editors. I was scary, of course, when I passed the border between the Soviet Union and Finland. But, I mean, they checked my documents, they checked my luggage, but there was nothing to show that they knew that I had something extra in my suitcase. So I passed the border and I came to Helsinki. I saw my Swedish editor, who was also Solzhenitsyn's translator. And I said to him, I have mail here from Moscow in my suitcase. And he said, what mail is that? And I said, I have a Solzhenitsyn Nobel lecture here. And then he decided that we should continue to Stockholm. That was not planned. And we went to the Swedish Academy and gave them the lecture.
So when you said that to him, what did he say? Do you remember the expression on the
man's face? He didn't know about it, of course. He has said afterwards that he immediately felt when he saw me that there was something special that had happened that I had to tell him. He saw that there was something. But then I have to also add that I never did anything behind the back of my people in Stockholm. My editor knew about this, the secret meetings, and sort of blessed them.
You must have thought about the fact that if the Soviet government realized that you were doing this, you could get in a lot of trouble.
Yes. I was afraid, but maybe I was also too young to be really afraid. I was maybe naive. We took precautions, of course, but I remember that the more meetings I had with him, the more scared I got, especially towards the end, because it all ended in February 1974 with his expulsion from the Soviet Union. He was arrested and then expelled. And that winter was terrible, because then the propaganda attacks against him just accelerated. Then it was very scary. Mm. But I never thought that anything worse could happen to me than expulsion as a correspondent, to be expelled from the Soviet Union. A couple of years ago, I wrote about all this. I published a book in Sweden called Alexander's Courier. After that book had been published, I was approached one day by an old man in the bus in Stockholm, and he said, can I sit down and talk to you? And he said, I have just read your book, Alexander's Courier, and it was incredibly courageous what you did for Solzhenitsyn. But I myself have been in the Gulag, he said. I spent 5 years in the Gulag. He was an old Hungarian Jew who had been captured after the war and been sent to the Gulag. He had been liberated and then turned up in Sweden. And he said, from my experience, I think if they had got hold of what you were doing and your secret meetings, they would have grabbed you and let you disappear, he said.
Yeah. That would be my expectation, that at the very yes, certainly they could have just thrown you out of the country, but I would think that it would also have been equally likely that you would have been in jail. And you could have just been gone, and you could have disappeared into that system that was the system that he wrote about and is maybe most known for writing that the most famous book, Gulag Archipelago. Yeah, and I suppose that the observation has been made more than once that the story about the microfilm and the transistor radio is just like something that you'd read in some sort of espionage novel.
Yes, and also it was like a spy novel, the whole thing, because although it was in real life, it was really a reality. But we took these precautions. I didn't have anything written in my apartment about the meetings, and nothing in my calendar. Everything was in our heads. We knew where to meet in Moscow. We knew the time of the day. We had the next meeting decided upon, the date for the next meeting. We had a reserve date. We had a reserve date for the reserve date, mm-hmm. in case something happened. And everything in our heads, nothing written down.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Stieg Fredriksen. He's now one of Scandinavia's most prominent international journalists. Back in the 70s, when he was just starting out as a reporter, he was a young man working in Moscow, and he had this relationship with the great writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He'll be talking about that this afternoon on the U of I campus at a 4 o'clock talk. It's a Millercom event. It's open to anyone who is interested, from our correspondent in Moscow reporting on Solzhenitsyn, the Kremlin, and the KGB. And we'll talk some more here with Stieg Fredriksen in a moment. What we'd like to do, however, is remind people that the great luxury we have doing the program on this station, that we don't have to take any breaks. We have these wonderful long conversations, sometimes with really interesting folks who come here because the university is here, and we can have them on the show. And we've been doing this for a very long time, and people have said nice things about the show over time. Well, now we need to turn things around and say, well, if you've appreciated this program, and in fact others that you hear on this station, these shows need your financial support. We need you to help pay the bills. And this is just one of those times that we depart from our usual programming to say that. You can call us. You can go online. Now would be a great time to call on with a pledge or to go online with a pledge. And in studio here to help us talk about that is Dave Teal. He's the program director for WILL Television.
Good morning. It's great to be here. And, you know, we really do want to encourage you this morning, if you've been listening to this show and really just been fascinated by these stories, we hope that you'll call right now at 217-244-9455. Now, you've probably heard that, I'm sure you've heard that the state of Illinois has some pretty desperate financial problems, and a lot of organizations have been affected, including, of course, WILL. We've received a 50% reduction in our state funding this year. We don't know what the situation will be like next year. You know, we anticipate it will go down further. There's even talk about the possibility of it being zeroed out entirely. So that makes viewer or listener contributions. Of course, I'm on television, so I usually deal with viewers, but listener contributions here very important, even more important than ever before. And so the number to call right now, 217-244-9455. You really are so important to this program and this station.
Yeah. We're here coming near the end of the effort for this spring. We set a goal. We hoped to hear from 1,000 people. And at some point here, we can get an update. But I know that we are at least halfway there. We're more than halfway there. But we need to continue to maintain that pace if we're going to make that goal. And it's really important because the money we are raising now, this is the money that will pay for the programs for the next fiscal year, and we're actually getting pretty close. That means the fiscal year that begins on the 1st of July.
Right.
So we're really coming down to the wire here on raising the money to pay for next year's programs. And as we've said so many times, the state support, the federal support has continued to erode very steadily over time. That's how it is. We've come to this point now for that 40% of the budget comes from listeners. And actually, we kind of like that. We'd really much rather be beholden to the listeners than to the government of the U.S. or of the state of Illinois.
Yeah, you know, it's true. You know, this way we do get that direct feedback. I mean, it really is your applause, your appreciation as a listener of this station that, you know, that keeps us going. I mean, I think mentally, you know, it's always nice to get that little attaboy. Yeah. But then also just in terms of the financial situation, I mean, it really, you know, we really cannot do it without your help. And I know, you know, you were saying that it's the end of the fiscal year is coming up fast. And I mean, I know I just planned the June schedule for television. So, you know, in a couple more weeks, we'll be talking about July. I'll already be in that next fiscal year mentally.
Right. All right. So, well, thanks very much. We'll talk some more, and we can get you an update and let you know how we're doing. But the important thing is, if you've been thinking about it, we hope that you'll take the opportunity this morning to do it. 244-9455 is the number. 217 is the area code. So if you'd like to call, that's great. If you'd like to go online, go to willpledge.org, and we'll take your pledge that way. We want to continue talking with our guest for this hour, Stieg Fredrickson. He is visiting the campus, and we'll be talking about some of his experiences as a reporter in Moscow back when there was a Soviet Union. This is a topic of his talk for this afternoon. And again, I want to say this is happening at 4 o'clock this afternoon, Night Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana on the U of I campus. It's a MillerCom event. It's free. And if you'd like to hear more from him, you should feel welcome. We do have a caller here, and others are welcome to call 333-9455 here in Champaign, Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here in Coles County on our toll-free line. Line 4. Hello.
Yes. I was just wondering, how can you be sure that the KGB was not aware of your meetings with Solzhenitsyn? I was just thinking, you know, they might have been aware of it, but decided not to make a big deal of it at the time, because I suppose at that time they probably wanted to treat Solzhenitsyn with kid gloves a little bit due to his international standing and international stature, and decided, man, not to make a real big deal of him meeting with a Western journalist. It wouldn't look too good to make a big deal of that. It wouldn't look too good to the rest of the world. And, of course, incidents like that, your meetings, might have built up over a period of time where they decided to expel him a couple years later. But I'm just wondering, are you, do you feel absolutely sure they weren't aware of your meetings, or do you think maybe they were aware of it and decided not to make a big deal of it? Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm pretty sure, or I'm definitely sure, that they didn't know about our meetings.
Okay.
I think they definitely would have liked to silence him and isolate him totally. If they had known that he had a channel out that helped him break his isolation, I am sure they would have stopped that. He was such a nuisance to them that with his protests and his writings, that they definitely would have liked to stop that.
All right. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I think, did you not then, after the Soviet Union came apart and it was possible to try to get at some of the records of government records, that you actually tried to find out what indeed they had known, or if they had in fact known anything about your meetings with Solzhenitsyn?
Yeah, that's right. I got a chance in 1993 to interview a man called Vadim Bakhatin, and he became Gorbachev's head of the KGB after the coup in Moscow in August 1991. So he was the last head of the KGB. And he told me that Gorbachev himself had asked Bakhatin to try to find out in the KGB archives what there was about the persecution in the 70s of Solzhenitsyn. And they did an investigation in the KGB. And Bakhatin came back to Gorbachev and said, "We have found out that everything in the archives about Solzhenitsyn and who was responsible for harassing him has been destroyed. It has been burnt, and it was burnt on orders of the then head of the KGB in July 1990. That is when the democratization of the Soviet Union was accelerating, and the people responsible for persecuting the dissidents wanted to trace, to take away all the traces so that they could not be held responsible or put to trial for what they had done in the 70s. So Bakhatin said to me, "We have found out that 105 volumes of archives were burnt about Solzhenitsyn in July 1990. He said it was the size of a small truck, he said, this volume. And he said, we will never find out. But, he said, what we found out was that the KGB in the 70s had a code name for Solzhenitsyn. He was called the Spider.
Indicating their very high regard.
Probably, yeah.
For the man. We mentioned, at least just sort of mentioned in passing, the Gulag Archipelago, which is probably his most famous book. You had some role in the publication, because the manuscript itself had it did exist outside
right.
of Russia, so
yeah.
It wasn't a matter of that you having to be involved in getting that out. But what was it that in communicating from Solzhenitsyn to someone who was in the position to publish it, you were the conduit for
that's
that?
Right. And also in response to the caller earlier, I think that was the last straw, that the publication in the West of the Gulag Archipelago in the winter of 73-74 was the last straw that that made the Politburo make the decision to arrest him and expel him. But I had one of these secret meetings with him in September of 73, when he suddenly told me that he had found out that the KGB had confiscated a copy of the manuscript of the Gulag Archipelago. That book was not known at that time. I knew that he had written something called the Gulag Archipelago. I knew that the book had been smuggled out to the West in the late 60s by French diplomats, I think. And I knew that people were translating it to English, French, German. I knew also that my editor had a copy. And Solzhenitsyn had also given copies to good friends all over the Soviet Union to keep the manuscript in good hands. They had given the manuscript to a woman in Leningrad. The KGB had found out about that, and they took her in, arrested her, interrogated her day and night till she confessed. And then they let her go. She went home and hanged herself. Because she had let Solzhenitsyn down, she felt. Mm-hmm. But Solzhenitsyn was now afraid that the KGB was going to use this copy of his manuscript to somehow discredit him or hurt him or do some damage to him. He was even afraid that they might kidnap one of his boys and force him to sign something in order to get the boy back or something. So Solzhenitsyn decided to counterattack. He didn't want to wait for what the KGB was planning to do. He said, I have to... He gave me a press release that night, which I gave to my colleagues, especially the news agencies in Moscow, where he told the world about this book, this documentary book about the camps. And then I also got a letter to his lawyer in Switzerland, in Zurich, who represented him in the publishing in the West. And that was a clear order to speed up the translations in the West and to at least publish the first volume in the West of the Gulag Archipelago as quickly as possible. And the book started coming out early 1974. It was a tremendous blow to the prestige of the Soviet Union. It gave the Soviet Union enormous negative publicity, and this was a documentary book. It showed, for example, that it was Lenin who started building the camps. Everything could not be blamed on Stalin and Stalin's terror. The terror started with Lenin, the founder of the Soviet Union, and he was sacred. He must not be criticized. I think looking at it retrospectively, the publication of the Gulag Archipelago in the West did an awful lot to undermine the position of the Soviet Union and what then led to the collapse of the Soviet Union.
And the knowledge, sort of the common knowledge that came with that, that there was this network of labor camps into which they put all manner of people that the government would have considered undesirables, both criminals and also people who were dissidents, political activists. It was not widely known in the West that these places existed?
Well, there were other books published in the 50s and the 60s, and there were, I mean, there were the revelations that Khrushchev came with in the early 60s, when Khrushchev had this the famous speech, first 56 and then 61, about the cult of personality of Stalin. I would say that in 1974, there were, in Western Europe, among in leftist circles, there were still illusions about the Soviet Union. We knew about Stalin's terror, but I mean the principles were maybe not so bad, the classless society and so on. But Solzhenitsyn, I think, shred the last of the illusions about the Soviet Union among many Western intellectuals. And he had to pay a price for that. And the price was that he got arrested and he got expelled from the Soviet Union forever.
Yeah. And until there was no more Soviet Union, and then he did get to go home and was living there when he passed in 2008, was living
right.
in Russia.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's talk with another caller in Fisher. Line one here. Hello.
My comment is I think Mikhail Gorbachev was one of the best world leaders of all time. And when he came into power, he actually really changed the way the world works in a very gentle, kind way. And also, I want to welcome your guest to Illinois. So just tell me about Mikhail.
All right. Can you do that?
Well, thank you for your kind words. I agree with you that about the greatness of Mikhail Gorbachev. And I have always said that I think it's one of the miracles of our times that the demise of the Soviet Empire could take place with so little bloodshed and so little loss of life, really. But on the other hand, it's important to say that I don't think that this is what Mikhail Gorbachev really intended when he said about the perestroika and the glasnost in 1985. His original intention was to improve the system, to make it work better by glasnost and by reforms. But he thought, I think, till the end that he would be able to keep the Soviet Union together, just make it better, work, function better. But he started something which he could not stop. So the development took over and passed him. He never really understood either the urge of the 15 Soviet republics to become independent states. He said to the very end that, but you must remember, we must stick together. We are a Soviet people. We are a Soviet Union. We had created something called a Soviet man. He didn't understand the nationalism of the other republics. Hmm. But he did a great thing by starting it, a really great thing.
We have about 6 or 7 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest, Stieg Fredriksen, is probably one of the best-known international journalists in Scandinavia, and we have been talking here about some of his experiences when he was starting out as a reporter, when he was a young man, back in the early 70s in Moscow. Covering what was then the Soviet Union and the relationship that he had at the time with writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He'll be on the campus here to give a talk. We'll talk this afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. So if you'd like to hear more, stop by. Questions are welcome. If somebody wants to get in here quick, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm just wondering if you can maybe say something about what some of the challenges for a journalist in Moscow today would be and how that would compare with what it would have been like to be a reporter in Russia when the Cold War was still on and when there was still Soviet Union?
Well, when I came back to Stockholm for vacation, people would say to me, isn't it awfully difficult to work in Moscow? It must be very difficult with the surveillance and the restrictions and all that. And I said, sure, it's difficult. It's difficult to work as a normal Western journalist. But on the other hand, it's very easy to work because you have only the official propaganda. You have Pravda, you have TASS, you try to read between the lines if something is going on. But really, there is only His Master's voice in the press, in the media. Today, you can say it's very easy to work in Moscow or in Russia because it's free for a Western journalist. But on the other hand, it's very difficult. I think it's more difficult in a way than it was in the Soviet Union because you have to know who owns the newspaper, what interest that newspaper stands for, what oligarchs' interests are in this newspaper or in this radio station. Mm-hmm. The main television networks are, of course, government-controlled today, like in the old days. And another thing is that if you are a Western journalist today in Russia, you're often asked to pay for an interview, to give a bribe, or simply pay someone if you want an interview.
So, and I don't know if it's more dangerous for a foreign correspondent, certainly in Russia, to challenge the government can be very dangerous. You could find yourself in jail. You could find yourself dead.
If you're a Russian journalist.
If you're a Russian journalist.
Yes.
Do foreign journalists face that kind of danger?
No, I wouldn't say that. No. But it's important what you say. We're talking about the Russian journalists because or Russian journalists, Russians, Russian fighters for human rights, respect for human rights, for example. This is unprecedented. I mean, that would never have happened in the Soviet times with these freelance murderers who exist in Russia today.
We have a caller here in Urbana. I want to make sure that we get them in the time that's left. Urbana, line one. Hello.
I have two quick questions. I'm not sure whether you were in Moscow at the time, but there were incursions in Swedish territorial waters, which was assumed to be probes by Soviet submarines at the time. I'm wondering if you could edify whether that report is accurate. And the second question, I just wanted you to talk a little bit about your perception of the quality of Western reporting, specifically American reporting in Moscow at the time. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Did you mean at the time or now?
No, at the time you were there.
Okay.
Thank you. 70s and 80s.
Okay. The question of the Soviet submarines in the 80s in the Swedish waters is very contentious in Sweden. Today I would say that it's questioned whether they were Soviet. There have been reports that they may have been minks, animals that made these sounds. But it is not clear yet what had happened really. But there is much doubt today, 2010, whether they were Soviet. The second question, I admired the my American and British colleagues very much in Moscow. They were very good, and they had very good contacts and very good sources, also among the dissidents. I would say that the coverage of Russia then was much, much better than it is today because of the cut down of the number of foreign correspondents, and the coverage today is much more superficial, I think. Hmm.
Do you think there are some particular stories, important stories, that we're missing or aren't getting the coverage that they should today about Russia?
Well, You cover the political issues. That's the normal. What I miss is a coverage of what's going on in society, apart from big politics. Mm-hmm. I always say that I regret, of course, the measures that Putin and Medvedev have taken to take back some of the liberties of the 90s. Russia today is an authoritarian state, but it's not the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union will never come back. Russia today is a much more open society than in the Soviet Union, although it was more open in the 90s. And that is not being covered, I think, enough. Daily life, how society develops. People, for example, the emerging middle class, how they live in Russia. But I know it's my own fault also. We tend to cover big politics. That's more interesting. The relationship between Medvedev and Putin is more interesting than daily life.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would hope you get some of both of those stories. I guess you have to cover the political story.
Yes.
Because that is important.
That's right.
But you also have to put that in some kind of context, and that's where the daily life comes in. Do you think we're coming down the point here? We just have a couple of minutes left, but it was a mistake, and how serious a mistake, at the end of the Cold War when the Soviet Union came apart. I think that some people in Western governments, perhaps in Europe and maybe even more so in the United States, said, they may have even said it out loud, well, Russia really doesn't matter anymore, and they sort of brushed them off. Which made the Russian government, very angry, caused them to sometimes to be maybe a little bit more belligerent, if only rhetorically, than they needed to be, because they still felt that they were a great power. Do you think that was a mistake?
I think there were mistakes made, yes, and to a certain extent, it's payback time now on the Russians with Putin claiming respect again for Russia as a big power. To a certain extent, the West took advantage of Russia's weakness after 91. Russia felt humiliated those years, it's true. But today, the Russian leadership has made it clear, for example, that we will not tolerate NATO enlargement further. NATO took advantage of our weakness in the 90s. Maybe, yes, but on the other hand, the countries who became new NATO members, this is what they wished. That this is what they wanted. They wanted to have this insurance policy to be members of NATO. So you cannot only say that the West took advantage of Russia's weakness. You also have to see that this is what these countries wanted.
We're going to have to stop there with our thanks to our guest, Stig Fredriksson. He's a Swedish journalist. He's Scandinavia's maybe most prominent international journalist. And he is here visiting the campus, and we'll be giving a talk about some of these things we talked about. I'm sure that there will be more stories and more to be said on this subject. They're titling it, From Our Correspondent in Moscow, Reporting on Solzhenitsyn, the Kremlin, and the KGB. This is an event in the MillerCom series, sponsored in part by the Russian East European and Eurasian Center on the campus. And he'll be talking this afternoon at 4, Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory on the U of I campus. It's free. Anyone who would like to attend should feel welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David, for inviting me. Thank you.
We have a couple minutes here. We want to continue also to encourage people to support the station. Here in studio with me is Dave Teal. He's the program director for WILL Television, our companion station. And we like to go back and forth in radio and TV and encourage people to support the sister stations. I'm glad he could be here with us in the studio. Do you, by any chance, did we get an update on where we are?
I didn't get a full update. What I have here is, I believe, 63 pledges since, I presume since this morning, $6,237. And so that's what I have for this morning. I don't have an overall update for the entire thing. So Okay. Hopefully maybe somebody will
write
in with that.
We'll get one. The important thing is that we can continue to add names to the list of supporters. We've
exactly.
set this goal. We wanted to hear from 1,000 people by the time we finished up here. We have a couple of days left. And if you've been thinking about it, well, now would be a great time to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, really, it is just, you know, like I said, a couple of days left. And this, you know, I mean, all of the pledge drives are important. I mean, I won't kid you about that. But these times really are very important to us because it is our opportunity to come directly to you, the listener, and say, you know, at a time when you're actually using the station and, you know, and to say that. Yeah, you know, we know that you know this is important, and we know you're out there. We know that this is an important service to you, and we hope that you will take this opportunity to support it with your phone call right now at 244-9455. That's, of course, 217 area code. And, you know, what's great now that we're on the web as well, we really have, I mean, potentially a worldwide audience here. We do hear from people all over the planet,
yeah.
and it is it's great. And we hope if you're out there and you appreciate the service, you'll support it too.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Dave. We're going to take our usual break here so that we can bring you an update on the commodity markets, and also we have some news from National Public Radio. And also, we better let you know among our supporters, these folks right here.